All right, all right. You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber, and tonight on Right on Radio, Liz Olds talks with Susan Prever about her memoir, Dancer Interrupted. What happens when our dreams of becoming a professional athlete, singer, or writer become impossible? For Susan Prever, a gifted ballerina, she believed it was the end of her life. She began a career as a ballet dancer and trained under George Balanchine at School of American Ballet in New York City. Susan has built an extensive resume of dramatic and comedic roles in a variety of contemporary and classic plays on a number of LA stages. Additionally, Susan is a beloved yoga teacher in Pasadena, California. For the last part of our show, I'll be talking with Cody Cassidy about his latest work, Who Ate the First Oyster? The Extraordinary People Behind the Greatest Verse in History. Who wore the first pants? Who first rode the horse? Who invented soap? This madcap adventure across ancient history uses everything from modern genetics to archaeology to uncover the geniuses behind these and other world-changing innovations. Cody Cassidy is a freelance writer living in San Francisco who spends his time playing ultimate frisbee and surfing. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio.
I'm ready for your reading, Susan.
All right. Hello, everyone.
I should have known that my arrival home wasn't going to be well received. Dad was pretty firm about that on the phone a few weeks earlier. And yet there he was, waiting impatiently in the arrival area of LAX, wearing his oil-stained work outside in the garage clothes, with cigarette smoke wafting from his carved ivory cigarette holder. I imagined that he would come to the airport dressed in one of his beautiful suits he wore to his law office. I imagined there would be some compassion in his expression and in the tone of his voice. I was wrong. "Grab your bags, let's get to the car," he said gruffly as I reached for my heavy luggage coming around the baggage carousel. He grabbed one for me, but I could feel his agitation at having to drive all the way to LAX as we walked quickly to his vintage Porsche. The cigarette holder dangled from his mouth as he loaded my bags into the trunk. On the 405 freeway, I stared out the front window, contemplating my next move. I love the change of seasons on the East Coast, and here I was, back in the LA heat and smog. The drive home to the San Fernando Valley seemed endless. Dad barely said a word. We approached our respectably small house on Placidia Avenue, built in 1936. It was just down the street from comedian Bob Hope's enclave, which took up an entire city block. Dad opened the wrought iron gate and got in back in the car, and as we drove up the long driveway, fear engulfed me. Mom had finished her shift at Children's Hospital and was sitting on the couch in the den waiting for us when we walked in the house. Getting up to greet us, she looked tired and a bit haggard. Her gray hair was untouched and her face was free of makeup, but she seemed happy to see me. "We're going to take care of you," she said softly with some true compassion. I fell into her arms and the tears that I'd been holding back since I was fired from my dream job in Cleveland fell onto her white nurse's uniform. She was going to make it okay for me to recover. She'd done it before and was particularly good at it. I gave up a part of my childhood to become a dancer, and I missed out on knowing who I was without the mirrors, the stage, and the deep connection to music that made everything else bearable. Now, Mom, who'd begged me in the last few years to go to college, would save me from this devastating fall from grace. Just her hug made me believe I was loved. Now I could let go and completely fall apart. She would be there to save me. I knew she loved me, especially when I couldn't take care of myself.
That's Susan Prever with a reading from Dancer Interrupted, her book about many things, actually. Why don't you give us a brief overview of the book?
A brief overview? Well, I start out basically still employed in my very last job and basically talk about how deeply it affects me to finally wear a tiara, because it takes a long time to wear a tiara in the ballet world.
To the tiara point, yeah.
Yeah, so I use the tiara a little bit of a symbol as when I, and in the second chapter, I'm fired, and I talk about how I've come home and how I basically have lost my complete self. I come home because there's nowhere else for me to go, except I do go to New York for a while, And I'm having problems in New York because the wrong men are trying to take me out. Very scary men, because I'm very vulnerable, not without my identity. And most dancers audition for another company when they're fired. I personally went into a very deep depression. And the deep depression didn't allow me to sort of stand up for myself. And so my only place to go was home, thinking that would be a place to solve my angst. I went home and it got a lot worse. And I did not leave my parents' couch, I hate to say this, for 8 months. I got up to go to the bathroom. I took a few showers because my mother forced me to. And I learned what it was to lose self. I learned what it was to, and I think a lot of people can relate to losing their job, losing maybe a writer's block for a writer, maybe someone who's a journalist. They just can't say the words anymore. Ballet was like writing a sentence for me. Ballet was like my full expression of my human experience, which was very young because I was only 23 when, or 24 when it all happened, when I fell completely. And so the story encompasses the how my parents made me crazier than I already was, because they didn't believe that it was a quote unquote spiritual. I felt that it was kind of a spiritual death. But my need as a young person was to show them that I could be worthy without the tiara. And I didn't have one anymore. And I wasn't worthy anymore. And they made me feel it. And not because they were pushy parents. It was because they expected things of me. I was no idiot. I could have done something. I could have pulled myself up. They were like, get a job. You'll be fine. Go back to work. I went back to work. I mean, I never worked. I was a dancer. I had a couple, you know, little jobs when I was out of work. But basically, you don't know the real world. And so the story encompasses breaking into the real world with a few different jobs, a few different personal encounters, because not knowing how to deal with regular human beings. I was used to backstage people, composers, dancers, musicians, and you know, a lot of young people, but the older people told you what to do, told you what to say. So that it was, and I dug myself up. I dug myself up. So that's what it encompasses. And then how I transferred my life into learning to have a voice. And that's the story, which a lot of women from that time, we're talking the 70s and 80s.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe didn't have a voice, maybe did, but because I didn't go to college, I didn't. My experience was as a vulnerable young woman out for the wolves. Just give me a dance job. I'm happy. I'm safe. And I was not safe anymore. So anyway, so I encompassed those things. And how my parents reacted not that well to my falling apart. Or not knowing what to do.
There seems to be in my three parts, three real distinct parts of the book. And the first one is about your life in the ballet. And I'm an old theater major, so I get it. But why don't you tell our listeners about that kind of wonderful and secret and occasionally unhealthy world of ballet and theater, and how you lived in that from the time you were like 14 or 13 or even earlier than that.
Well, the world that I grew up in, even though I came from LA, I went to New York very young, and at School of American Ballet, if you didn't weigh 90 pounds, you were fat. So, and Balanchine, who was the greatest choreographer, artist of that time, for ballet anyway, liked his women that way. And so the competitiveness was not only about being good at what you did, it was about how skinny you could be. So the eating disorders were rampant. So flash forward, even when I'm 23 20 dancing for companies, it's not as bad, but it's still, you can't eat. And I wasn't a bulimic. So there is a competition also because the youth, you have to be youthful to dance. Your body gives out. By the time you're 35, you're probably done, unless you go into modern dance, which some dancers do. But the competitiveness was not, you know, it's very competitive, but I never related to it that way because I loved it so much. It was really just, what can I do? And maybe that was a failing. Because you kind of have to like move someone else over to make your place more seen. And that wasn't in my nature necessarily, being a little bit sensitive. So, and maybe a lot of dancers are like that, but I didn't have the support underneath me because my parents didn't come from theatrical. It wasn't a theatrical family. They didn't understand what I was doing. They knew I was going to never make any money. And it was never a money making thing. I made a little bit in the companies I danced for, but it was really only enough to survive.
It was the love of the thing. It was the love of the thing.
Yes. And I mentioned at the beginning of the book that it's a calling, and the dancers are kind of like monks. They're so disciplined and they love what they do. Now, once you get older and your real personality starts to come in, some of those things start to leave you, and dancers can become a little bit wild because they've been so disciplined and so held down for so many years. So I experienced that when I stopped.
Talk about your injuries. I mean, I think of dance as an athlete. I think of dancers as athletes, and injuries, even kind of what would seem like minor injuries, can be career threatening and sometimes even career ending. And you had several. Why don't you talk about those?
I had a bad back injury early on dancing in Chicago for a while. And when you're 20, you just keep going. Mm-hmm. You keep performing with pain. I didn't even collect workman's comp, which you can collect if you're injured. You just keep going because 20 is 20. Just like an athlete, you just keep going. You find a way to work around it, but it does affect you. I had some ankle stuff early on because everybody gets tendonitis. You're used to a certain amount of pain, and because there's so many endorphins when you are dancing on stage, you don't even feel it until you come off. Mm-hmm. So I got used to that pain being happiness, the freedom of space. And that may be something that athletes feel the same way, because it's just, you are at the height of your physical body. You're at the height of it if you've trained well, which most dancers do if you get to the point of being a professional dancer. I never was great enough to be the prima or the maybe even the soloist, but I was getting there. But then mine was the mental instability that took me down. If I didn't have that, I may have gone on a little longer. I'm not sure. I might have. I don't know. But no regrets. You move on.
You got laid off the Cleveland Ballet and decided not to audition again. Was that a hard decision, or was that kind of like, okay, this is what I'm going to do? Or how did you come to that?
That's a good question, because it wasn't literally a decision. It was, when you get fired and you have no backbone as a human being and you're young, which I was, I just turned 24, I think. I didn't have a solid base to go, somebody else will like me. I just went, they all will hate me. Mm-hmm. The depression was so bad. I mean, it was clinical depression. I mean, I could barely walk, let alone dance. So it just got progressively worse. And it really had to do with the depression more than anything. A person that is emotionally stable would have just gone, stayed in shape, and you go to audition. Just like an athlete that gets left because they're not meant for this team. You're not right for our team. You go to another team because you're basically a team player. If you're in the corps de ballet, which I was, you got to stay in line and you play with the team. So I took it harder than I should have, but that's okay. There's no shoulds. I took it in a way that let me just fall down the rabbit hole. That's all.
Well, that seems to me to be the second part of the book, is that deep, deep depression that you went into. You want to start by describing some of that, what it was like and what you were doing?
Well, once I got home to my parents, there was the wish that they'd say, it's going to be okay. And that wish did not come true. It was more like, get up, go do something. I don't care how sad you are. I don't care how depressed you are. I don't care how much weight you gain because you are, all you do is sit around and eat. I mean, I kind of laid down. I barely sat up during the day. I mean, my depression was so deep that I couldn't get up. And occasionally I did, to have a cup of coffee or maybe sit with my parents, but all they'd talk about was what was wrong with me. So it became too self-involved. I just wanted to escape from that. And I sat and did crossword puzzles all day. I couldn't read because, and I love to read. I'm a huge reader. I wasn't ever a writer, but I was a reader. And I couldn't read because I couldn't focus on anything. I couldn't focus. It was just, the depression was of that kind where it's suicidal, but I was too chicken to commit suicide. And so my health was going down. It affects your body, mind, spirit. I'm a yoga teacher now. They worked together very well. And I understand that when I teach as a yoga teacher, I'm very connected to people's sort of essence of what they feel inside. I think it colored my whole life because I understood falling that deep and not being able to think clearly, to feel anything. When you're in depression, you cut everything off. It's beyond sadness. Those people know some version of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it runs in my family. So I did inherit some of that. But my parents were like, that era was like, just get up and do something, you know, you'll be fine. Plus, we were all spoiled to some extent. You know, the struggles were not monetary. We weren't rich, but it wasn't monetary struggle. But so that's it. And I did go to some therapy and I was on antidepressants briefly. And I said, no, that's not what it is. And I dug myself up. So I dug myself out of that.
Now, your mom and your dad kind of reacted differently to you. How did they react? And what's your feeling now about all of that?
Well, the feeling about it now is my dad, as harsh as he was, God bless him, he died pretty young. He died at 59 because he was a big smoker. God bless him. He knew, he was very hard on me and not nice, but he knew that I needed to get up. He knew that I had to find a spine for myself. My mom, all she did was enable me. She got some thrill out of me being very weak and very vulnerable and very help me. What do I do? And so it was a complete battle between the two of them over me. And it was just way too much attention on a 24-year-old, way too much attention. And I had lived on my own since I was 17. So it was sort of like, I was a child. I became a child again. It was not comfortable at all. But I wanted them to finally say, oh, we'll help you. You'll be okay. We love you this way. Mm-hmm. We love you without your tutu and tiara. That never happened.
No.
Not that they loved me, but with the tutu and tiara either. And I think they did love me, but they just didn't know how to show it. That's all.
Right. And it seems like your mom was more, quote, codependent. Your dad was more, quote, tough love.
Tough love, yeah. I think he'd been through the Korean War, and I think those guys are so tough. They're hiding so many things. Who knows what they're hiding? Yeah. So he and that was never talked about. So who knows? You know, he had a pretty big position. I think he was a lieutenant, and he loved, even though he became a lawyer, he loved being in the Army. So he loved that discipline. He loved that, you know, control and blah blah blah. So who knows what his thing was? He was never going to be a soft, sensitive guy. That wasn't him.
Now, eventually, after you tried the therapy and the meds and all that stuff, you came to a decision. It does sound like this was a decision where you were going to pull yourself up. You were kind of tired of being a lump on the couch, and you made this conscious thing that said, I don't know if these are the exact words, but it was kind of like, I'm going to have to do this. I'm going to have to do this or I'm not going to make it. Somehow I'm going to have to get better.
Exactly right. I was going to either die or get better because I couldn't live like that. Mm-hmm. I knew that. And so that shows that my whatever mental instability I had was still telling me, you are not insane. You're just really depressed. Mm-hmm. So I had some awareness that I was maybe doing this to myself. Maybe I was doing this to myself. I mean, there is a physical reaction. There was physical depression, mental depression, but maybe I had done a lot of it to myself. So,
well, I think didn't one of the one person talk to you about how you had spent such a long time with all these endorphins in your body, and when you stopped moving, the endorphins kind of went away, and that's yes. a way to get depressed anyway.
Yeah, it was. And it was an early I went to a psychiatrist when I lost my first job at the Levski Ballet, and I didn't lose it. We were on a hiatus, and I wasn't fired from there, but I would go through depressions when I stopped dancing. Instead mm-hmm. of just being in class and doing swimming or whatever, I just would get depressed thinking I would never dance again. And it did affect my brain. The brain chemistry definitely was tied up to those endorphins. It definitely was. And not so much anymore. I've learned to cope. Whatever depression I get, I know it will go away. It's not forever. So then I didn't know because I was young and naive and I needed those endorphins so terribly.
Yeah, knowing that this too shall pass is a good thing.
right. But athletes, I'm imagining dancer is like an athlete. Athletes must go through the same thing because you're playing for so long at a really heightened physicality.
High level, yeah.
And then you stop and you feel really good after for a while. You stop too long. Where's your high?
Mm-hmm.
Because I was never a drug person. That never happened. I had the drug. I had the endorphins. They're fab. And now listen, a lot of people like to work out and it does help. It does help mental health. It does.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, but for someone who's obsessed with a sport or an art like that, it's more like obsession than just going to the gym. It's real obsession because there's a perfectionism that comes with it. And it's really sad, very
yeah.
sad, the perfectionism that comes with it. Very hard on young people, but you buy right into it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And then the third part of the book, and this is a little bit more nebulous, but it becomes very clear as you read that after you pulled yourself up by your bootstraps, supposedly, or you did what you needed to do to relieve yourself of the to survive, yeah. You very gradually get better. You get a job. You meet some people. You go to work, and then at some point you decide that you want to become an actor or actress or however you say
it's fine.
It.
Actress is fine.
It's interesting because when you were leaving the Cleveland Ballet, what was his name? Dennis.
He said Dennis could act.
You could act. He gave you a letter of recommendation to some Broadway producers. But actually, at that time, it seems like you felt it was an insult. And
I
now here you're going and doing it.
I did at the time. Yes, I did.
How did you make that change in your brain over that course of however many years it was?
I always felt more alive on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been introduced to some great writing by great playwright by a friend of mine who was an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And I remembered the vulnerability of some of the characters and what I had experienced myself as kind of a vulnerable young woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, let me see if I can find a voice in this. I didn't mm-hmm. know. I had been encouraged by a couple of people. I didn't know, and I wasn't very good at first because you're so used to expressing with your arms and your legs and your feet and your head turning a certain way. And acting is much more contained and much more psychological.
Mm-hmm.
And dance is much more, it's not completely primal, but I think it's more primal. That's why you see little kids dancing a lot or singing a lot. So I took it as a challenge, and I like challenges and I like process. So it was a long process for me because I had no voice whatsoever except to take food orders. And I talk about that in the book because I was a waitress for a while and I did learn to be a little tough, sort of tough, just so I could be a waitress and make mm-hmm. my living that way. But there was a part of me that wanted to find the soul of the dancer that I was. And in some writing, I felt that. It didn't mean I could execute it. It took me a long time, but I wanted to find that deep part of myself that was expression of truth or expression of something bigger than myself that was unanimous or universal. And you can only find that in the great, great writers.
Yes.
And then, et cetera, et cetera. So I was drawn to some of this great writing and trying to figure out how words could be as deep as a développé or a grand jeté, or moving across the stage in a way where you feel free. So that's kind of what it became for me. How am I going to find this?
And it sounds like you went to a wonderful school. Was it called The Loft?
It was called The Loft. And Peggy Fury had run that, and she had passed away, and her husband took over Bill Traylor, and both of his daughters were wonderful actresses. But I had heard about it through the grapevine, and I felt a home there. And we worked really hard, and Bill really liked me. And so that was nice. I felt a connection with someone, and then he died like 2 months later.
What a drag.
It was a drag. It was a drag, but I had learned, you don't let this, you just keep going.
Keep going.
He'd given me some support, like this might be right for you. And I was already 27. I was not young. I had gone through so much to just make a living, try to find a school, not live with my parents because I didn't want to, just make a living and take care of myself and find a way to learn this craft that was late to me. You know, it was late, even though I'd been on the stage a lot. It's very different. It's very different than dancing. Very different.
It sounds like you had a lot of roles, but the big one was Blanche DuBois. Is that the one that kind of set your mind that this is really what I'm going to do?
Oh, no, no, no. Blanche DuBois, I just played last year.
Oh, really? Okay, I'm sorry.
I played it older, yeah. I mean, because stage, you can't tell people's age from stage. I played, Pinter really got me. I love Harold Pinter.
Okay.
I did a good Tennessee Williams, Kingdom of Earth, which not a lot of people have seen. It's a great play. I mean, some people don't think it's his greatest play, but that got me ready for Blanche, even though, I mean, I'm doing this so much later in my life. But I did do some great roles before that, but nothing speaks to me like Tennessee Williams.
Yeah, yeah.
He's nothing speaks to me like that.
Well, we're almost out of time. I just want to thank you. We've been speaking with Susan Priver, author of Dancer Interrupted. It's a great book. And as much as we've talked about in this half an hour, there's much more that could be talked about. So I highly recommend reading it. How do people get a hold of you? What's next for you?
Well, what's next? I'll have a couple more radio things, you know, or a podcast. One in Portland is a TV thing, but a couple of things, nothing big, but some things. Hopefully I'll get the word out. My website, you can buy the book off my website if you want. It's connected to Amazon, is www.susanpriever.com.
Okay.
And so you can get it from there if you want. And yeah, a couple more. I have a book signing here in Los Angeles with a writer who's a student of mine, actually. So just carrying on. Hopefully I'll be able to get it out there because it could be helpful for some people.
Keep it going. It certainly has a message. It certainly has a message about what, not just the discipline and learning of art, but also what to do about depression when you're depressed. I mean, it's a big thing.
Big issue. Yeah, big issue for so many.
Yes, it is. Well, we're out of time. I'm sorry that we're out of time, but thank you so much for a wonderful interview. Susan Priver, author of Dancer. Priver?
Priver? It's Priver with a long E. Yes, it's okay. It's okay. I thank you, though. Thank you for the interview. Great.
Yeah, it's been wonderful. And so thank you very much, and we will bid you adieu.
I'll bid you adieu. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Hope I figure out how to turn this off.
Due to the COVID-19 situation, the Rain Taxi calendar has been either canceled or postponed. We also don't have up-to-date information about what different stores are doing right now and what businesses are currently operating. Therefore, we will be announcing the phone numbers of stores in the Twin Cities area. Get some paper, get a writing instrument, and call for more information at one of the following locations. Majors & Quinn, you can call at 612-822-4611. Once Upon a Crime at 612-874-3785. Moon Palace Books at 612-454-0455. The Loft, 612-215-2575. Next Chapter Books, 651-225-8989. Eat My Words at 651-243-1756. Bookhouse in Dinkytown, 612-331-1430. Red Balloon, 651-224-8320. Mayday Books is reached at 612-333-4719. Birch Bark Books is 612-374-4023. Uncle Hugo's and Uncle Edgar's Bookstore, the Hugo side, you can call at 612-824-6347, and Edgar's at 612-824-6394. The Milkweed Bookstore, you can call at 612-215-2540. Subtext Books, 651-493-2791. Wild Rumpus, 612-920-5005. James and Mary Laurie Booksellers, you can call at 612-338-1114. Once again, that's 612-338-1114. Dreamhaven is 612-823-6161. And lastly, the Paperback Exchange at 612-929-8801. This has been Right On Radio's COVID-19 Bookstore Update. Stay well, stay safe, and now this.
Under his belt, strapped a deerskin quiver of arrows to his back, slung his longbow over his shoulder, and set off in pursuit. He was 5.5 feet tall, thin and wiry strong, with legs and lungs well conditioned for the altitude and terrain. As he picked his way up the mountain, he did so with the speed and grace of someone who had spent a lifetime hiking the steep slopes. He kept pace with the man, but was in no rush to catch up. He knew the man would take the well-trod trading path at the top of the Otzol Alps that the spring melt had only recently cleared. He avoided the densely wooded Valsinalis Gorge, as his target had done, by climbing, descending, and climbing again, placing him to the south of what's now called the Simulian Pass. As he approached the ridge, he could see a wisp of smoke rising from a small gully up ahead. He unshouldered his bow, pulled an arrow from his quiver, and crept toward the top. Shall I keep reading?
That's good. No, that's just fine. You were just listening to Cody Cassidy read from his new book, Who Ate the First Oyster? Cody Cassidy is the co-author of the popular science book, And Then You're Dead, which was translated into 10 languages, and a former bookstore clerk in Buenos Aires. He's a freelance writer, editor, and lives in San Francisco. Cody, thanks for being on Right On Radio with us.
Thanks for having me.
So my first question for you is, I was wondering when you first got the idea for writing a book that became Who Ate the First Oyster?
I was interested in first. I was finishing my last book in which I was sort of researching the first people to perform different crazy stunts. But I became a little bit more interested in prehistoric firsts because I wanted to find people whose names were not written somewhere and who we had to do a bit of digging through various, talk to archaeologists and geneticists to try to find out who they were and what they did and why it mattered so much.
Yeah. One of the things I found interesting reading is I think you dispel this notion that primitive humans were these brutish savages. They're far more than that, weren't they? I know you described them in the book as needing to depend on an encyclopedic understanding of their environment in order to survive.
Yeah, I think there's a misconception that we sort of equate tools or technology with intelligence, but that's not quite how it works. There were certainly as many, there were more than a billion people that lived before in prehistory, so there were certainly many geniuses among them, and that isn't really even speculation. That we can see it with the inventions, with some of the inventions and discoveries that they made.
And so my first question regarding these inventions is, I always kind of assumed the wheel and axle have been the first invention in history, but you mentioned the book, the first invention occurred 3 million years ago before humans really evolved. I was wondering if you could talk about that and who invented it.
Yeah, this is in ancient times. It was invented by a young mother. She was an Australopithecine. This is a species sort of halfway between a chimpanzee and a human. She was covered in fur, and she slept in trees. But she's one of our first ancestors to walk upright, which introduced a problem because she was a young mother with a baby who could not hold on. She had to carry the baby, and this is an incredibly dangerous period of time for both mother and baby. Chimpanzee babies can't hold on for 2 months, and this time the mothers lose nearly half of them. So, in the case of this Ma, who I've named her, this young mother, she would have had a baby who couldn't hold on for far longer. So, she must have invented a way of holding this baby to her, which is simply just a baby sling by tying an overhand knot and a piece of leather. She was able to strap this baby to her, and it was even a more remarkable invention because it allowed humans to solve this sort of smart bipedal paradox, which is that how we have such large brains and narrow birth canals to walk upright, and the answer is that because mothers can hold on to babies with baby slings long before they. So these babies can be born prematurely when their heads are quite small.
Yeah, a great lesson I know you mentioned in the book is how Ma's invention allowed other mothers to learn and copy this tool, which is, for Homo sapiens, this ability to copy and learn and compound ideas is a large attribution to our success as a species, right?
Yeah, I like that this was the first one because it's if she had just made a baby sling and nobody had copied her, it wouldn't have mattered at all, but it turns out humans are excellent, and even our ancestors are excellent at copying each other's inventions. Social learning is one of our greatest skills. We are sort of technological plagiarists. Anytime we see someone doing something a little bit better than us, we can learn and copy that, which is a unique ability. And the fact that it started so long ago is pretty interesting.
Right. I think what's fascinating about that in relation to the rest of the book is for me was learning how this technical plagiarism, these tricks and tools that we use by our human ancestors caused morphological changes within our species and allowed us to keep on evolving. I was wondering if you could maybe talk about that in relation to the discovery of fire.
Yeah, I think fire is probably the greatest shift in our evolutionary history, and this occurred 1.9 million years ago, and the reason we can say it occurred then is because there's a dramatic evolution that occurred right then as well. It was when we shifted from being Homo habilis to Homo erectus, which is a really big change. Homo habilis was like 4 feet tall and covered in fur, and Homo erectus is very human-looking. They're more like 6 feet and have no fur. And the explanation archaeologists have come up with for this dramatic change is that someone learned how to spark fire on demand. And I've called this person Martine, and the reason she probably, or the way she was probably able to do so is that she was chipping stone tools. And a lot of people think that if you just chip two rocks together, you'll eventually start a fire, but that's not quite true. You need a particular kind of rock. It's called a pyrite, which is loaded with pieces of iron. And when you knock a piece of unexposed iron and it hits oxygen, it'll burn, and it will burn hot enough to spark a fire. And she might not have been the first person to do this, but she might have been the first person to understand why it happened. And this is probably the greatest mineralogic, the greatest geology discovery in human history.
You also mentioned how having people come together around fires, it actually probably favored people who were more trustworthy and had a level of predictability around fires. It made survival more more favorable for people who had nicer brains.
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence that it made people nicer. Gathering around a campfire, you need to get along. You need to be social. And it's part of a long process of humans, and it's an important part of the long process of humans sort of being able to be more social and get along and speak and tell stories. And a campfire plays a large role in that.
I think we've come now to the namesake of the book. Who ate the first oyster, Cody, and why were they probably a prehistoric astronomer from 164,000 years ago?
Yeah, this question sounds like a joke, but it surprisingly has an answer. It was the oldest oysters were found around 164,000 years ago at the bottom of South Africa. And the person who may have eaten the first one is someone I call Oyster Gal, and she was not only a bold eater, but as you say, she was a genius, an astronomer, because she didn't live along the coast, and she would have had to travel to the ocean to gather her oysters. And this involves the problem of the tides. You can't get oysters most of the time. You need the tide to be super low. So the only way she could have gathered her oysters efficiently is if she was able to put together that a full or new moon coincides with super low tides. So she was both bold and a bit of a science genius.
Yeah. Something I liked in the readings of all the stories from the book is you portray each of these figures from our past as individuals, like you call Oyster Gal, for example, where you don't really detach them from their humanity. They're curious, they're hungry, they become tired. I was wondering if this was something you thought about often while you were writing this book.
A large purpose behind the book was to talk about people who lived in prehistory. I think a lot of times we think about these people as peoples, as a sort of faceless mass of cavemen. But I wanted to talk about the individuals who made these discoveries, and I think describing them and describing their motives is part of it. But also, I think giving them a name is a big part of thinking about someone as an individual as well.
Yeah, I really like that a lot. In the book, you talk about the invention of the bow as probably by accident and most likely a toy. Why is that?
The bow is an incredibly unique tool. It doesn't replicate anything in nature. And it's a little bit difficult to see what the inspiration was. So in many of these cases, we think it was discovered by accident. It was probably the first arrowheads are found 64,000 years ago in South Africa. And the person who made them, this culture was probably, they were working with strings and beads. So it's presumed they tied the string to two ends and sort of discovered deflection in the system and found it fun to launch sticks. But that doesn't describe the lethal weapon it became. It describes a toy. And it took many, many more innovations to turn a little stick-launching toy into a lethal weapon. And that's also a really common theme throughout weaponry, actually, is that they began as toys, like the boomerang and gunpowder and rockets all were toys before they were developed enough to be weapons. And so I actually think that the first person to use this weapon was probably a child.
Yeah. I want to ask you now about the first great masterpiece, the panel of horses in the Chauvet Caves that occurred 33,000 years ago. What's impressive is the artists of this cave, they played with perspective and shading and even a prehistoric version of animation. Researchers also believe that there was a form of an apprenticeship or art school. Is that right?
Yeah, this is a cave that was painted 33,000 years ago. It's in the southeast corner of France. And it's, I think we think of most cave paintings as basic stick men, but this is most certainly not that. It's a really beautiful tapestry of charging horses. And it's so it's so well done, and it uses techniques that in many cases we didn't think were around until the we presumed were invented in more modern times, but like in the Renaissance. But he uses, as you said, perspective. He uses animation, because the legs almost appear to be moving because of the way that they're drawn, and he uses sort of the different reliefs, the different texture of the cave to create a sort of 3D effect. And it's, the artistry is so consistent, it seems you can't, he wasn't born with this, he was certainly developed it in what must have been a school of art, that is, because the style of artistry is even consistent throughout many different caves throughout Europe at this time period.
I was taught growing up that the earliest hunter-gatherers probably crossed America as a result of following migration patterns of mammoths and other large mammals for food, but in the book, you come across a different conclusion. I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Yeah, the first Americans were born on the land bridge, as many of us heard, but this word bridge is a little bit confusing because it was a huge piece of land. It was bigger than Texas. It's now sunken, but it was between Alaska and Siberia. But they were sort of some of the greatest survivors in human history. They lived up there for nearly 10,000 years, but were prevented from moving south because at the time Canada was covered in ice sheets, and these were skyscraper size, so it was basically impassable. And the first people to come here, I call him Dersu, who led a group of people down the coast nearly 16,000 years ago, right when the ice was first melting. They sort of used kayaks to hopscotch along down the Canadian coast until they made it past Vancouver, beyond the ice sheets. And then the world that they entered was unrecognizable to the one that we know. It had lions and 125-pound beavers and mastodons and camels, so, and mammoths. So it was a completely new America, or a different America, and then they exploded into it. They made it down to the bottom of Chile within 1,000 years.
The compulsion for them to do it, though, it was out of curiosity. It was more the sense of discovery and something new that they didn't know that they were checking out. That's what I was really intrigued by, that even then, there's this innate sense of trying to understand the world around them and going out there and trying to find what's there.
Yeah, I found that really interesting, too. I think another way of humanizing these ancient people, I think sometimes I certainly thought of the desire to explore as a sort of modern invention, but it isn't. There is plenty of evidence in other cases, such as these South Pacific explorers, this culture called the Lapita. They discovered islands so quickly, there's really no other explanation for their drive to seek new lands than just simply to see what was beyond the horizon. So I think in the case of the Americans, that's the best explanation as well. There was nothing that was forcing them to leave.
I want to move around here a little bit. The first surgery in history was done 7,000 years ago through a procedure called trepanation. What was this procedure like, and how did the first surgeon, who you dubbed Mr. Zero, conduct it?
So it's an ancient procedure. They were found around, these skulls were found around 7,000 years ago, and these are some of the first farmers to be in Europe. But what I found most shocking is that the procedure itself is dramatic. It's carving a hole in the person's skull. It is, and not only did they do that, but the person survived. We can see from evidence around the bones that there was some healing that took place. And on top of that, this procedure is actually performed modernly as well. It's called a craniotomy. It's, of course, using different tools, but there is a medical explanation for it, and it's when a skull injury takes place, you need to, in some cases, release some pressure that builds on the brain. And so this surgeon used an obsidian tool to cut through someone's skull and shave through their skull, but it may have actually been doing some good.
Yeah. We were just talking about how curiosity was actually, it wasn't just an early development like I assume it, but with Dr. Zero, you found that this also interests the idea that authority was a recent development in Homo sapiens probably 7,000 years ago. How is the authority introduced through humans and farm cultivation?
Yeah, one archaeologist I spoke with thought that, because 7,000 years ago seems like quite a long time, but it's actually fairly recent compared to the vastness of human history. And so one explanation as to why surgery is so recent is that until farming, there may not have been this sort of sense of authority in this, which is sort of the foundation of every modern professional relationship. You trust your car mechanic to know more about cars than you do, and you submit to his expertise. But this is a relatively recent invention development. And before farming, everybody was more equal. Nobody had a lot of possessions. And without possessions, there's not some people who have more than others, and there's not specialization in different fields. So they think it wasn't until someone had the authority to, as a doctor, that another person would allow them to cut into their skull, which is a pretty dramatic decision if you think about it.
Really? Have to have a lot of trust in them, what they're doing. Writing wasn't invented, curiously enough, how I would imagine it, as a form of self-expression, but as a means of managing debts and tax receipts. Can you talk about the first individual with a name in history?
Yeah, so writing had, as you said, it took, it didn't just spring up. It sort of was a long period of development of, as business became more complicated, keeping track of people who owed you what became more complicated, and writing was the answer to this question. So the first person whose name we know is not a king or a prince. He was an accountant. His name was Kushim. He lived nearly 5,000 years ago, and he was the accountant at a brewery in Mesopotamia. And I think that he was his name appears on a receipt. It's basically him proving to someone else that he had purchased some barley. But the curious thing about him, this sort of first famous person in some sense, is that he wasn't very good at his job. We found a few other examples of receipts that he wrote that have some pretty egregious errors and mistakes in math and in some of the recipes that he was writing. So even though he's the first person we know, he was a somewhat boring accountant, and he wasn't a particularly good one.
These boring accounts also are probably led to how we developed the first ever joke, though, which I think is funny enough. We have historical proof showing that accounts have a sense of humor, which I think is really good to have.
We're not going to think he had a sense of humor now, because I'll tell you the joke, but I'll warn you that it was it's not funny. It's 4,000 years old, but it goes something like, when the lion came into the sheep's pen, the guard dog put on his best leash, mm-hmm. which... is not funny, but you can sort of see the humor. A modern retelling might be like, when the shark fin appeared in the water, the lifeguard remembered it was his lunch break.
Yep.
It's a sort of joke on the dereliction of one's duty. And the person who wrote it was probably a scribal school teacher. These were lessons that he was imparting, both morality lessons, and they were also writing lessons on his students. But it's also one of the first funny things, or first non-accountant-related writing that we've ever seen. So even though it's not funny, it's much funnier than everything that was written before it.
And we are at the end of our interview almost, but I do have one last question. Of all the subjects in this book, what did you find the most fascinating for you to research, or what is the big takeaway that you enjoyed the most?
I got really interested in who drank the first beer, because the question began as a sort of... funny, who was this kind of Homer Simpson type, but it actually was really a groundbreaking shift in the trajectory of the human lifestyles, because this was a person who lived around 16,000 years ago. I named her Osiris, and she was one of the first people to gather wheat and rye seeds. They were living in the Middle East, and these were rare and difficult to gather, but when she did, she would have left out her, made a little gruel, which is a watery granola, and left it out in the sun. And after only a day or two, it would ferment into a mild beer. And again, she might not have been the first person to do this, but she had the courage to try it. And she would have recognized the taste of alcohol. But then the ground shifting moment that this was is because we now think that people first began gathering wheat intensively, not for bread, but for beer, which is pretty a really big shift in the course of human lifestyles.
We, Cody, are out of time right now, but I want to say again, thank you so much for being here on Right On Radio. You've been listening to my discussion with Cody Cassidy talking about who ate the first oyster. Thank you so much, Cody. I had a blast reading this. This is a wonderful read, so thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.
I'd like to thank our guests tonight, Susan Prever and Cody Cassidy, for being on our show and the listeners who make this show possible. You can find more news and info about Right On Radio at kfai.org/program/Right On Radio. Plus, listen to recent episodes.